This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know how I've been talking lately about how we're all so good at offering favors to people, but so reluctant to ask someone for help ourselves? It turns out the same thing is true for mental health. We talk about mental health more openly than we ever have. The conversation is everywhere. And yet, when it's our turn, when we're the one who actually needs to ask for help, somehow it still feels too hard. That gap is real, and BetterHelp went and measured it. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from doing so. Sit with that for a second. Nearly everyone agrees that reaching out is the smart, healthy thing to do. And yet most of us still feel the culture pushing against that wisdom. We've won the argument in the abstract and lost it in the moment. So here's the question I'd put to you, the Team Human listener. When's the last time you encouraged a friend to consider talking to someone? And when's the last time you gave yourself that same permission? Closing that gap doesn't start with a policy. It starts with us, treating it as normal, out loud. If you've been thinking of talking to someone, BetterHelp makes it easier to start. It's online, it's flexible, and it fits the life you actually have. 30,000 fully licensed therapists, a commitment to match you with the right one, and more than 12 years perfecting the online therapy experience. Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Taking care of your eyes shouldn't be a hassle. That's why Warby Parker is a one-stop shop for all your vision needs. Our prescription glasses and sunglasses are expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Stop by a nearby store or use our app to virtually try on frames and get personalized recommendations. Did we mention we offer eye exams and take vision insurance too? For everything you need to see, head to your nearest Warby Parker store or visit warbyparker.com today. That's warbyparker.com.
Hi, I'm Darina, co-founder of Quo. If you run a business, you know the team that responds first wins the customer. You've probably opened your phone to a bunch of missed calls and no voicemails. Those are missed opportunities and exactly why we built Quo. Quo is the business phone system that helps your team handle every call and text right away. Join over 90,000 businesses that win more customers with Quo. Try Quo for free at quo.com/tech. That's quo.com/tech.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Michael Gargiulo stalked and slaughtered his female neighbors in L.A. in the 2000s until one survived.
She painted a picture that you could never imagine.
In a first on Mind of a Monster, we dive into a case that's still active. Did Michael's murderous rampage start in the 1990s when he was just 17?
His impulsivity and his rage was starting to peak around that age.
Listen to Mind of a Monster, The Hollywood Ripper, wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. We're here today with my friend, Jonathan Larson, editor, writer, and everything of the fucking news, although he has other editors and helpers and all sorts of people working with him now. We're going to be talking about the state of things and what the fuck we can fucking do about it. Jonathan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, as always.
I want to start in some ways where we left off emotionally. After I had you in the studio, a few months ago, maybe only 5-6 months into the second Trump administration, and I felt a little bit like you were being kind of sanguine, kind of like talking me down off the ledge. I guess mostly it was, you know, like I was concerned about the election results, votes actually being counted. And you were saying how it's really hard to do that. And why would they, you know, lose to Biden when they're in power and, you know, and then somehow fake a win when they're not in power and all that. But I don't know. I'm feeling a little icky these days. Like we're no longer looking at the signs of impending potential threats of authoritarianism, but we're just like soaking in it. Do you feel are we in it?
We're the frog in the boiling water. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, the frog jumps out of the boiling water. We can't jump out. There's a screen on the top. You know, air's coming in somewhat, but no, we can't jump out. What are the ways in which we can avoid authoritarianism? I'm thinking now, what are the ways we live under and hopefully get out from under authoritarianism?
So I would say a few things in response to that. One is, you said we spoke, I guess, back in the spring, maybe, and you were nervous about them stealing votes, stealing elections. And I, you're suggesting, was perhaps overly sanguine. So I would point out that Democrats have romped in all the elections since then, overperforming expectations. So whatever mechanism we were afraid of, they don't seem to have come close to implementing them in time for the November elections. So I think that's a good sign, not only for where the electorate is, but also for where the election mechanisms are. We don't seem to have seen even meaningful attempts to compromise them. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't still face huge challenges with voter suppression tactics, but those, I think, again, they didn't work in November. So I think there's right. still cause to be optimistic that those things remain in place and responsive to the electorate.
Right. I mean, and how many voters can you suppress? I mean, at a certain point, if the people have a 70, 80, 90% majority, you can suppress 20% of the voters and it still registers.
And, you know, a phrase that I use in the fucking news all the time is politics are Newtonian in the sense that if you suppress 80% of the vote, 80% of people will now know they've been robbed of the vote. And you will now have 80% of the people in whatever district we're talking about who have been robbed of the vote. And you have just now created a massive political movement, which most likely is going to restore the vote to a good chunk of those people one way or the other.
Will they know they've been robbed of the vote, or will they just think our polls are wrong? Look, oh my God, turns out my neighbors, you know, do like authoritarianism.
Right. But if 80% of the people are not allowed to vote, are purged from the rolls, or because that's what voter suppression means is.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right. You purge people and lose their things or say they were double voting. You just prevent them from casting a vote rather than finagle it after they're in.
Right. And we've seen this in various states over the years. Five-figure voter roll purges, six-figure voter roll purges, you know, however many hundred thousands of people, they just declare you're out of there. And you know, to be fair and to be reality cognizant, some of those voter purges aren't terrible because the data they're working from are things like change of address forms or things like that, right? And so they're literally purging people who actually shouldn't be voting there because they literally have moved. The danger is where you get states that do things like, if you don't respond to this postcard in 2 weeks, we'll assume you've died and have gone to hell and we'll take you off our voter roll. Those are where you get problems. But if you get 80% of the electorate in any physical area, getting those postcards and then finding out they've been purged from the roles, enough of those people are going to be posting on social media, talking with neighbors, that there will be awareness. That's the trick with voter suppression, right? Is you've got to do it enough to make the difference between where the two parties are without doing it so much that people just, you know, flock to the other party and demand reform. It's trickier with things like, you know, the historic suppression of the Black vote, because those communities, Black communities, were very much, you know, not considered full citizens by the white community. So you weren't going to get, it's a lot easier to suppress the vote in some ways when you're doing it for horrific, divisive reasons that are established and inculcated within the broader overall population, right? Men were just fine for 100 years or however long it was with women not being able to vote. They didn't see that as voter suppression because women were not seen as fully realized humans entitled to representative democracy. So that's also a problem.
Right. I mean, and that's the re-unhumanization of people is part of the project. That's right. Why they love the right. book Unhumans. You know, the J.D. Vance blurbed, which argues that, you know, liberals are less than human, that they are unhuman. Therefore, it's really okay to, if necessary, pick them off with black right. copters or yeah. death squads. But certainly, if they're unhuman, they shouldn't be allowed to vote and screw up the American project.
Of course. Of course. That's right. So the answer to that is reject dehumanization. That's hard because right. a lot of people would like to dehumanize Nazis, fascists, Trump, J.D. Vance, right? A lot of people
right.
who support the policies that I'm going to presume you and I support are also fine with dehumanization. But once you endorse the method, well, then why shouldn't right. they adopt it? And we've seen that in case after case.
When there's this kind of protest and unrest, on the one hand, the danger to what you're saying, the danger is for people to start looking at members of ICE and dehumanizing them. I mean, it's tricky because they're kind of dehumanizing themselves. Once you put a mask on and stuff, you're way more stormtrooper than you are Luke Skywalker, right? They're a lot easier to shoot.
They want the tactical momentary advantages of non-humanity. They want to be seen as machines, as automatons, as Robocops. You know, you now have 30 seconds, that kind of thing.
Right. But they also don't want to be, I mean, in theory, don't want to be identified by neighbors.
That's right. Or posted online, like this guy, you know, the guy who shot Renee Good is now famous online. It's going to be pretty difficult for that guy to, you know, get a non-ICE job, I would imagine, or even keep an ICE job once the Trump administration is over. I do want to circle back to something you said at the very beginning that I didn't address, which was talking about how do we get out of authoritarianism. And I think it's a valid question, but I also think that we can help ourselves more by asking it in a different way, which is, When we say, like, how do we, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion, or at least there has been, over, you know, is this authoritarianism? Is this fascism?
Right.
And to some extent, that's used as a litmus test, right? Which side are you on? And I understand and don't argue with the thinking behind any of that, but I think there are more effective ways to frame the issue, which is not to demand a judgment from people on the entirety of the project, for a few reasons. For one thing, the vast majority of Americans have not been personally impacted by what this administration is doing. Now, you know, you can make a case where inflation impacts everyone, but then there's the argument that the president, in any case, tariffs are not, you know, typically seen as a watermark of fascism, right? So in terms of the fascist things that are out there that are being done, I don't know that it's helpful to ask people, tens, if not hundreds of millions of people who haven't personally been fascismed or authoritarianed, whether they are living in that kind of system. Because a lot of them, I think, for understandable reasons, are likely to say, no, I'm good. I can say what I want. No one's suppressing my speech online, all of that. So I do worry that you're kind of being overly determinative about who you're talking to and recruiting, and potentially risking pushing other people into the camp of going, oh, I guess I'm actually okay with what's happening now.
Right. This is authoritarianism. It ain't so bad. The mall's
exactly.
open. My kids are going to school.
You and I are here having this conversation. So if this be authoritarianism, let us make the most of it. And the other thing I would say is that instead of trying to have a discussion or a debate or a defining line around that's premised on sort of ephemeral umbrella definitions of authoritarianism, whatever the particulars are that lead us to conclude this is authoritarianism, I would suggest go with those particulars. Don't wrap them up in a brand name. Go with the particulars, right? It's I think things like, you know, do you find the shooting of Rene Good defensible? Do you think our government should be able to do that? I think there, tactically, you're liable to get a lot more people to go, yeah, that is a problem. And then you can have a discussion about, well, what does a solution look like? And you don't have to mention authoritarianism once, but you're talking about the elements of it. So to my mind, it's more of a tactical question, I think, than it is even a philosophical question. I'm not saying that there isn't a philosophical debate to be had about whether it is or isn't. But I also think when we talk about it, we're talking about a system with a lot of different parts. Not all of it is authoritarian. There are still state and local governments. So, are we talking about it? It just gets very messy very quickly in a way that I think tactically is not helpful. And also, right. I think there's a morale factor, right? If you tell people we're the frog, we're boiling to death, and we're in an authoritarian pot of boiling water. And by the way, there's a screen on top of it. I don't know about you, but I'm going to give up. I'm just going to be, I don't know. I don't know the way out of that. So I also fear that the questions circumscribing people's situations in a way that does make it seem hopeless.
In some sense, you're saying if we respond more tactically and practically to what's happening on the ground. So again, in Minneapolis, it's like, oh, they're taking away people we consider to be our neighbors in ways that kill them and don't seem appropriate to, the way immigration reform should happen in a even fairly enlightened place. So we're going to stand here with our bodies. We're going to do this. We're going to vote this way and do this media and create these actions. It's practical. Yet, if we live in New York City and see the ICE and National Guard phenomenon moving eastward, from Portland and San Francisco over, and then we see,
reporting in from the front lines. Yeah.
Right. And they're buying a warehouse from Carl Icahn over in Orange County above the Tappan Zee or the Cuomo Bridge in New York near Hudson Valley. Oh, getting some warehouses there for ICE to stow however many people. It looks like, they're kind of preparing to come on and do this right here. Again, it's not necessarily paranoid to begin looking at how do we as New Yorkers, what's the most healthy, resilient preparation that we could do for impending.
Right. So, activism and all that kind of stuff is definitely outside my normal wheelhouse. But I do think, as someone who thinks about messaging all the time in my own work, I think it's really important, essential, not to telegraph anything that has the whiff of defeat or fatalism about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, I also think it's realistic for people to understand that once the votes were counted in November 2024, everyone should have been prepared for the possibility, you know what? There are going to be bad things that happen. There are going to be lives that are lost. There are going to be economic, opportunity costs. There's going to be bad trajectories for people's lives. It's also worth remembering that that is true of the U.S. government always. And that's not to say, therefore, it's okay that Trump does it. The point of that is to say, we've lived through it before, not just Trump, right? People's lives ended and were ruined under Biden and Obama and Bill Clinton. Like, the government does that, right? And so the thing I think to do is to focus on where are the remaining levers, right? And I think you and I have had this conversation before about if Trump were committed to fascism as opposed to just committed to lack of impulse control, which seems to me to be his fundamental guiding philosophy,
right,
his lack of impulse control, he would have rounded up Congress and the Supreme Court and other courts on day one and just said, thanks for your service, although it's not like him to say thanks for your service.
Or it's also he's into, capital appreciation. And he's got to be able to open a bank account in Qatar and get, Venezuelan oil money and the peace committee or whatever he calls it. The war on peace. What do they call that?
The peace board.
Middle East committee. Right. The peace board. Yeah.
Right.
And they got to pay $1 billion each and it goes into his account.
Not only did he not, though, abolish Congress, he has actually been deferential to it in some very important respects, right? He last year they passed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which I referred to by its acronym of OBUBBA. And in theory, he could have not bothered with the legislation, not bothered with all those phone calls to jawbone with members of Congress and make them get on board. He could have just told the Treasury Department, write me a check. Right. So he is still honoring enough external checks and balances that there are recognizable levers of power out there. Right. We've seen U.S. attorneys booted from their positions because judges said you can't be there. We've seen members of Congress, including Republicans, stand up to him on nominations more than anything else. I think it was Tom Tillis who for weeks was blocking every single ICE nomination because Kristi Noem wouldn't show up for FEMA hearings. So what I think is important is to zero in for people who want to be active and want to, if not accomplish something, at least feel like you're trying, all of which, by the way, none of that do I condescend to. I admire and hold it in esteem. The thing I think to do is to focus on identifying where are the levers of power to which he actually responds and what is your most effective way of moving those levers of power. And I think there are things to do with a lot of policy. My big fear with Trump has been that as he is stymied.
Running a business means juggling a lot of moving parts. And when your communication tools can't keep up, things start to slip. Missed calls, slow replies, scattered conversations. They're not just frustrating, they're lost opportunities and revenue left on the table. That's where Quo comes in, spelled Q-U-O. Quo is the number one rated business phone system on G2, trusted by over 90,000 businesses. One shared business number for calls and texts, so every conversation stays visible, organized, and accountable. It works from an app or computer. You can keep your existing number, add teammates, and sync your CRM, letting you scale without adding complexity. And with built-in AI, Quo logs calls, summarizes conversations, and flags next steps, even after hours. Stop missing customers. Stop leaving revenue on the table. Try Quo free and get 20% off your first 6 months at quo.com/tech. That's quo.com/tech. Quo. No missed calls, no missed customers.
Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate. And they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
In year one, he kind of attempted to exert his will everywhere. My concern is that where he is stymied leaves gaps, which now have to accommodate the entirety of his impulses. And so my concern has been that where he might have moderated otherwise, now we're going to see much more unrestrained exercises of power, like something like, you know, getting Maduro in Venezuela. That was a massive military operation, and it was, you know, pretty unthinkable, I think, a year or so ago. And so my I tried to ignore the Greenland stuff for a bit, if only because I didn't think much was going to come of it ultimately. But I did have that nagging concern that, oh, Greenland is actually somewhere where Congress doesn't have a lot of mechanisms right off the bat to stop him, and the courts are going to have very little to say about it. So that's been my concern, is that we're going to see him focus his efforts more on the places where he can act unchecked immediacy.
That is, in a sense, right. He has more power internationally than nationally, you know, because he can get a bunch of European Union prime ministers to, they'll all say mean things into microphones, but so what? You know, that kind of makes him happy.
Tariffs is a button he can press without, I think people underestimate how much the lack of impulse control matters. He wants to be able to do things that feel immediately like he's doing something. I declare a tariff, boom. I'm sure he walks on air for weeks after each one.
But one of the interesting things is that we talk about government and politics now in terms of this person.
Yeah.
Right. What? How do we control this? How do we stop that? And it's like, right. Oh, enough Congress people talk to him about this. He.
Yeah.
Again, which is just different for me as an American.
I mean, it is and it isn't. We've especially since World War II, we've been a very executive branch focused government, and that's showed up to our detriment. You know, that's reflected in our media. Our media has been very presidency focused even beforehand. But I agree that you're right. And one of the messages I give in the fucking news, implicitly, but sometimes explicitly, is don't stand politicians. Don't demonize politicians. Focus on issues. And when politicians do the right thing by your issues, celebrate not them, but that. Whatever they did, celebrate that thing, not that person. And I do think that it's really important for Democrats, for anyone who sees them as oppositional to Donald Trump, to move towards and start speaking in terms that are evocative of a collective politics, which I think is kind of what you were getting at. Like, what can we do? And what do we want, and how can we achieve it? Those kinds of things. Mamdani in New York is kind of an interesting case because he's very much about that, but he's managed to make that succeed by being very me-focused.
A personality. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see. I, to Biden's credit, I thought he did this to some extent. That was probably to some extent because he was so institutionally of the Senate that it was in his nature to support and boost, you know, the congressional branch But you actually did see, I thought, some indicators, don't press me now on which ones, some indicators of him trying to bring the executive primacy down a little bit. But I do think that's something that sort of savvy politicians can start reminding us, just with language, if not action, but just reminding us that this is supposed to be a collective endeavor. And in fact, it's an essential mission, because the rise of Trump is directly attributable, I would argue, to the erosion of our collective sense of politics, right? It's always been, you know, acceptable for people to say, oh, I don't like politics, I don't talk about politics. You should be embarrassed to say that, because when you say, I don't like politics, I don't like talking about politics, you would sound like an insane person if you said, you know what, I'm not really interested in the supply of oxygen to my lungs, right? And yet, right, politics is the mechanism by which you get oxygen to your lungs, as opposed to particulate sulfur.
Totally. No, and I experienced that. If I go to, most shocking thing to me the first time I went to England, and I go in the pubs in England, and there's Labour and Tory people sitting around the same table arguing,
yeah,
so fiercely that beyond what we would even argue in America on television debating each other.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
And they're friends and they're drinking. And it's like, because there's this one reads The Guardian, that one reads, you know, the Times of London. And wow. And then, you know, after my shock, horror, and fear wore off, I was like, this is so refreshing. And these folks seemed more educated about political science than the political science majors I knew at the Ivy League college I was going to at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did that manifest, this superior understanding of political science? How did that show up?
Oh, understand. I mean, it was at the time, it was a, end of Thatcher, pre-Blair. So there was arguments about the market, whether the market can work out, you know, her whole idea of there being no such thing as society. Then they were having a complicated conversation about council flats, which is basically public housing.
Right,
and there was this shift from, they were selling council flats back to the public in these ways. And it was whether that they were really being sold to the people who lived in them or just being put on the market for them to become part of a real estate thing. And it was like, the level of conversation and and these were, you know,
and it was a watershed moment for British identity after Thatcherism. Sure.
Yes, it was. But these were cab drivers. It was not like your New Yorker reading elite Manhattan people who argue about the op-ed page. These were real people.
They displayed familiarity with politics that their counterparts in the U.S. would display about sports.
Yes. That was the thing. There was a subtlety and a history and a continuity and even disagreeing. It's like, you know, it's like it was like more like arguing with William F. Buckley than, you know, arguing with just an idiot. And, and it was like, oh, shit. But the bigger thing was there was more capacity for disagreement, for argumentation. Right. That somehow we've stamped out, we race to kumbaya, we race to, you know, as if the reason we should have a discussion with our counterpart is to reach
is
a common
to agree.
Understanding. It's like, what if it's not? What if it's to figure out how do we maintain our opposing stances and somehow not kill each other at the same time?
Right. I mean, I do think persuasion is a good goal, but I think it's a lot less likely to happen when someone is well informed about it and has thought about it. But I think there's a few interesting things going on there. One is I certainly agree with you, and it's a pet peeve of mine, that there is a toxicity to the elevation of agreement and compromise as a goal. It's not. It's just one tool that you can use to pursue your ends. But I think Democrats in particular, because we don't really see Republicans en masse talking about the value of compromise and unity with the party they consider the party of pedophile freaks and groomers. But Democrats, I think, are so, for whatever psychological reason different political leaders have, Democrats are dying. They're desperate and panicky to convince, especially the media, that they're not going to fight. Their starting position is to look for compromise, which is not how compromise is supposed to work. And the other thing I would say about it is I think a lot of people trace it back to Newt Gingrich in the early 90s, but I suspect, you know, there are certainly elements of it earlier, which was the conversation shifted from what is the right way to achieve goals, very broad goals that we all share, right? Pretty much everyone agrees that we don't want a country in which people starve to death, in which children go hungry, in which medical emergencies or crises lead to people losing everything. Pretty much everyone agrees on that. And so the debate I suspect that they're having in your pubs is about what is the best way to get there, and what are the best tactics and strategies and means to use to achieve those things. And here the debate has become much more childish in that you're a bad person. And the debate is not over how do we achieve the goals, right?
Right. If we have 15 million people in America living in their cars, we can either, I mean, as
how do they afford cars, Doug?
Right. Well, there's that.
No, I'm kidding.
There is that. I mean, whether the cars move or not. But they're basically, we can ask, in America, the question we're asking is, does society owe them anything? Does society owe them a way out of their cars? Or are they in their cars because it's their own fucking fault? That God doesn't love them. They're lazy or they're drug addicts or whatever. And let them die in their cars.
Yeah. Yeah. It used to be, the idea, I think, used to be that capitalism and the invisible hand would raise all boats, right? That you know, in a prosperous economy, without the government restricting rich people, because then those rich people will go out and create jobs for everyone. We've replaced that with Calvinism.
Right. However much we may have disagreed with Calvinism, Thatcherism, Reaganism, libertarian, whatever, and Ayn Rand, at least even Ayn Rand was thinking, this will raise all boats. This will lead to the best society. They have the same, at least their telos is.
It's just a tactical.
It's universal wealth, right? It's just this dumb, stupid way to do it. But at least your heart's in the right place, you asshole.
Right.
Right. Now it's no longer that. It's this idea of the kind of, it's this perversion of Christianity that the unsaved should die. That they really are, we repatriate them or let them wither on the vine. And that's consonant with the tech bro idea that we need to amass a whole lot of wealth, even if that means people will die, so that we have the billions or trillions necessary to get to the next place.
Yeah, I was actually going to quibble with you, including Calvinism, in the isms
in the good.
That are debating how to. Well, right, because Calvinism's, you know, ethos isn't that the system will take care of everyone, unless you consider it in the theocratic, theological sense
of God. Right.
Some
if
people will
poor,
go to
God
hell.
Doesn't love
good,
you.
We took care of them. Right, exactly. And so yeah, once that became a dominant theme, I think then the idea reverted to even the invisible hand shouldn't lift up everyone. Some people do not deserve it. But also I would argue, I would quibble with you referring to this as a perversion of Christianity. Just as an atheist myself, I tend to be very skeptical about any implication that there is a Platonic ideal of Christianity that we should all recognize. Oh yeah, that's it. And if you're not in that, you, then it's not Christianity. I think there's a lot of historical evidence over the past 2,000 years that you know, dominant forms of Christianity for hundreds of years in different societies and cultures was really bad.
Yeah, I guess I would say then a perversion or distortion of some of the good things that Christ said and did in the stories. The Christ I read about in the stories, sure, seemed to like poor people and be about sharing and doing good stuff. This killing stuff doesn't seem like part of that.
So here's where I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
Yeah.
There's a right-wing evangelical preacher who I think you and I may have spoken about before, named Ralph Drollinger, who conducts, right, weekly Bible studies for the House, the Senate, and the White House. And you can go online and you can read them. They're at his website, Capital Ministries. And he argues that what Jesus did was great, and we should all do that. But what he teaches members of Congress, mostly Republican, but not exclusively Republican, what he teaches them is that God designed the world with a set number of spheres. I don't remember if it's five or not, but there's, you know, family, the church, government, private industry, maybe charity, I don't remember. And that in the best ideal form of the world, as God envisions it, those spheres each take care of specific elements of a functioning society. And what Drollinger says, and this is not a fringe belief, as we have seen in the policies enacted by his followers, government has a limited role, which, by the way, happens to be a very consistent thing with Republican orthodoxy over the years, right? Government should be limited. Drollinger says the same thing and says there are theological bases for believing that. He's not against feeding the poor. He just says that's the work of charities, individuals, and the church. And, you know, this goes back, this is just a theological variation on the invisible hand, that if left alone and supported where it should be supported, capitalism, the private sector, will create a society, magically, I would argue, will create a society where everyone is taken care of. So they would argue, we're not against those people. Obviously, there's the waste, fraud, and abuse people. They're bad and should never get food. But underlying that, the argument they don't want to make is that Jesus doesn't think government should do these things. He thinks you should do these things.
And not both.
Right. Well, and my retort to that, not that anyone asks me, but my mental retort to that is always, okay, so if individuals should be doing this, what if they decide to create a national organization that effectively and comprehensively does this for them? Because that's what a government is.
Right. Right. What if we want to do it at a scale and we want to enlist our government in that? Well, because it's a separate sphere. You're going to corrupt that sphere, right? Because God has this sphere plan. God made the sphere plan.
He's so wedded to the methodologies. Yeah.
What I was going to get to in the sort of the seeming movement eastward of the National Guard and ICE and all that, what feels in some ways like the designed intentional provocation of people. I mean, if I wanted to gather up what I saw as illegal immigrants, I could do it faster and better with more subtle, less violent means.
You mean like Biden did for a while?
Well, they did, actually.
Yeah.
There are ways to do it. I mean, this is obviously a show of strength for all sorts of other reasons, but so if there is perhaps an intentional provocation of people into protest that can then be argued is insurrection, and the Insurrection Act ends up being used, doesn't that mean we don't get midterm elections anyway? Do you honestly believe that if Trump and his fellows genuinely believed that they were going to get clobbered in the midterm elections and potentially then prosecuted for a lot of the stuff that they've been doing, aren't they too far in to let this go?
I think so. I'm going to push back on intentionality the same way I pushed back on ismizing things. I think tactically and strategically, it's a mistake, even for us internally, to think in terms of intentionality for a few reasons. One is we don't know what the intention is. But the other is also, if we decide that we're capable of guessing what the intentionality is, that sort of limits our response to what else might be motivated by that intentionality, as opposed to being open-minded to, well, let's assume we don't know what the intentionality is and look at the full range there. And also just tactically, I think it tends to turn off potential allies, or at least potential agreement. If we say, well, they're trying to do X, Y, and Z. I don't sense a lot of tactical strategic genius among the leadership ranks of these folks. I do think that it's more likely to arise from lack of impulse control.
Right. And that because I'm a logical person, I'm then projecting a strategy on these things. It's just like if you're a child and you have a drunk parent, you will still, as a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old, try to create some logical sense. What do I do that leads to this? Why did I get beat this night and not beaten that night? Why did daddy do that? And so you create a narrative around it. There, if this is just a man going into dementia with personality disorders and impulse control and a bunch of people around who are just trying to please him no matter what, then what looks like an intentional eastward march toward New York with perhaps a unstated target date of when they invade and how they do it and building these warehouses around in order to prepare for it, that these are not necessarily readable signs, that these could just be whatever.
And look, I certainly agree with that interpretation, and I like the analogy as well, as someone who probably did a fair amount of that as a child. But also I would say, even if we say that's the plan, I think it's worth questioning, well, if that's the case, is this really like a steadily moving upward line, or in your case, in your question, an eastward moving line? Because they were in Portland, they were in Los Angeles, they were in Chicago, and yet they're not staying. They're not even accomplishing the things that the blowhards are saying they're there to accomplish. Remember, Kristi Noem said something like, we're here to liberate the people of Los Angeles from the socialist governments of the, I don't know how specific she got, but basically the mayor and the governor.
Right.
Well, that didn't happen. And so, and the other thing is, I think it would be very tough to credibly manufacture the kind of a form of protest that would, in the popular thinking, justify a clampdown so draconian that it meant restricting voting rights. I think that would, again, that it goes back to my point about politics being Newtonian. I think the backlash to that is something that Trump would not be happy with, and that would risk just overwhelming the system, politically speaking. So not to mention potential internal pushback, right? We've already seen things like reports that we had resignations over the Venezuela boat murder policy. We've had reports of pushback within the military, of people pushing back on potential Greenland invasion plans. So I think the idea that even the U.S. military, even after a year of Hegseth, who, again, I would argue, not super strategic and smart about reshaping the institution to his ends, the idea that there's not going to be any pushback within the National Guard or the enlisted ranks to ending the vote in U.S. cities, I think that's not likely to be the case. And I think even if it turned out to be the case, my guess is there are a lot of people within the Trump administration who wouldn't want to test that theory by trying that out. And the other thing is, I think Trump, you know, he has said things like, I'd love to be a dictator. And I do think he's jealous of their ability to act without impulse control. But
we all
also think, what?
We all are.
That's right, right. We all have our inner Kim Jong-uns. But I do think that he wants to be seen as succeeding within a role, a presidential role, that's still recognizable as president, right? I think he wants to feel like he succeeded on the same playing field that other U.S. presidents succeeded.
Yeah, but now who's the one projecting intentions and reading the mind of the enemy now?
I absolutely, you know, acknowledge that that's speculative and so forth. I'm not saying, and therefore we should do X, Y, or Z. I'm just saying that's my sort of explanatory theory of the case.
I want to take 30 seconds to thank our sponsor and then come back to my big question, which is really going to be about our area of expertise, which is media control, and how that's affecting everything. But first, into my special camera, I want to thank Kobe. Remember Kobe, right? They make the dryer sheets. I've been talking about those. Well, now Kobe's making these Kobe laundry buds. And to be honest, I mean, I've used them. I tried them, whatever. They're fine. I'm not a dryer sheet person. I just don't really use them that. But these, they sent me these. These are fucking kick-ass. So laundry, these are, you know how you pour liquid or pour powder or take one of these weird Tide plastic jelly whatevers and throw that in the washer? Well, this is different. These are like mesh little pucks, but these are all goodness. They're all good. Now, don't eat it or anything, but it's like good. These are not chemicals. These are things that are good. So they go in the water and then, you know, the water in your laundry machine, you know, it goes back out into the world, but this is all good stuff, except for whatever dirt's on your clothes or microplastics are in your clothes. This is not making badness. This is making goodness. And I used it and this actually was really good. And I'm like super sensitive. So I use Tide Free and all those things, blank of everything. This is like free before it's even free. They don't have to make this free. It's just free of all that. See, I just had it on my hands and there's no Bernie. This is like for your babies and stuff. Use this thing, Kobe Laundry Buds. And the other thing you're doing, Kobe is getting there. They're Everyone's Earth, the sponsor. They're getting there very, very close to change diapers, which are going to be these biodegradable, perfect little diapers that won't make mounds of plastic dead diaper. We want those, and those are coming soon. And by getting Kobe Laundry Buds and Kobe Dryer Sheets, you're not only supporting Team Human, but you're supporting the development of that product, which should be out in just a couple of months. See, media. Sponsored, but it took me, 4 years to find a sponsor that I could actually
Because of microplastics. So I was sitting here being
exactly
excited to hear about
those
it.
Pods, yeah. Right. It's those pods that you get, everyone else is there. These plastic things with detergent inside.
They look delicious.
Really bad.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And kids eat them and die and stuff. But these, I'll bring you these. Do you want scented or unscented?
Are they
in stores?
I'm an unscented
no.
guy. Are they
no.
in stores?
Oh, yeah, you could buy them. Just go to Kobe and COBI, and you can buy them. And if you use Rush 10, you get 10% off these puppies.
Rush 10. Okay.
Yeah. Rush 10. You can buy them and support Tom and Kobe. But I'll bring you a few if you want to try them first, I understand. But they work. They clean and they're good. So Larry Ellison is not in a position where he actually has to hawk Kobe Laundry Buds.
He's,
I mean, he does just
super
at
duper
scale.
Rich. It's just at scale. That's true. Just at scale, and they're not Kobe clean, right?
No,
he's the drier buds of civilization. Exactly. He's living off the toxins.
Yeah.
But when I look at the consolidation of media is something they taught me about since I was in high school. And then I read Robert McChesney and learn about political economy of media. And, oh, look, it's 5 or 8 big corporations that own all of them. It feels a little different to me now. And I know I can even rattle off what sound like more names. I mean, there's, you know, Substack and Amazon and Apple TV and all. But there's something about the consolidation of media now that feels a little different, you know, particularly when like Larry Ellison and Elon Musk are so close to our government and the way it's working. Are we, as you understand it, are we just in, you know, William Randolph Hearst, U.S. government, Guatemala, Chiquita Banana? Are we in that territory, or are we in something else, or are we just going back to that maybe, which feels weird to me?
I don't know. I tend to think that I certainly have my complaints about the erosion of government regulation on media ownership, right? Which a lot of that was actually accomplished by Democrats in the 80s, helping an Australian gent named Rupert Murdoch expand his media empire.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're so pro-immigrant. Maybe that was the idea. But I do think that it would take a lot more than we've seen from the U.S. government for people not to have the option anymore of platform shopping and finding places that work for them. I'm actually a little surprised that Blue Sky hasn't taken off more than it has. And every once in a while, I try not to post on Twitter anymore, but every once in a while I do go over to sort of like, how are you guys doing in there? You know, see what's going on. And I'm still surprised at how many people are still actively participating there. But just the fact that it's, you know, Twitter usership is down, and Blue Sky is obviously growing. So I think we're more likely to continue to see this fracturing of media rather than an outright end of the kind of media that you and I would want to ensure is still free and able to express itself. And then, you know, there are a lot of other interesting factors, I think, as well, such as European regulatory. I'm not expert on it by any means, but they are, especially with Trump, you know, being antagonistic, European regulators seem to be quite willing to step in and fill in that gap. And I think, what was it, the UK, I guess, just banned social media for anyone under 16, I think, something like that. So I do think it's sufficiently messy and anarchic at the moment that I'm not too worried about a monopolization, a corporate monopolization of media. What I am worried about is the possibility that media ecospheres, right? Truth Social plus Fox News plus the New York Post or whatever you want to put in there becomes big enough not to eat everything, but just to provide a complete feeling bubble in which some people can live and in which alternate realities really can take hold.
Yeah, it is interesting because I've spent a lot of time on Fox during various, what felt like to me, various major world events. You know, whether it was the proposed invasion of Alaska, the desecration of NATO, the strikes in Minneapolis, the killing of
Rene Good,
of Good in Minneapolis, the things that seem like major news stories, and I would look at Fox, and the only stories that were on really were about the supposed corruption, that there were
the fraud scandals in Minneapolis. Yeah.
Somalian daycare centers that a YouTuber went to. They wouldn't let him see the kids, and or they were closed. And he said that meant that there was the trillions of dollars of Minneapolis tax money being given to Somalia.
Right, right.
And that was the story on TV.
Yes, yes. I do find it interesting, though, that you do see it. It varies from subject matter to subject matter how much they're willing to break ranks with the administration. But you certainly see on the economy lots of times they'll sit there and they'll go, "Ooh, these are bad numbers." So I think what tends to happen is not epistemic closure so much as there's a gradation, right? And certain things will seep into Fox at a slower or faster rate, depending on, you know, I'm sure you could write an algorithm to determine why, you know, the killing of Renee Good. But my guess is the killing of Renee Good has also made it onto Fox in some form or another. But different things permeate at different rates. You're basically talking about the scenario that I was fearing, which is people literally become wedded to an alternate reality, at which point it can be very difficult to try to even have your pub conversation with those folks because they recognize an entirely different set of facts. But also, more importantly, they're focusing on very different issues, right? They want to have the debate over how do we fix fraud in Minneapolis. And we who don't watch Fox, we already know those people have already been prosecuted by the Biden administration, right? You're talking about a crisis that's basically over already. But the point is that we can't even have a conversation about what we want to do about problem X because we don't even agree anymore on what the actual problems are. You also said desecration of Alaska earlier. I think you meant Greenland.
Oh, right. Greenland, Alaska. Well, yeah, Greenland. Greenland's the next Alaska, right? There you go.
Except for Russia. Yeah.
Except for Russia. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Are we giving?
Right.
I think we're, yeah. But I think at one point he was talking about giving Alaska to Russia.
Oh,
right?
I see. Well, wait.
I think he was. We're part of it. I know we forget because it goes so quickly. But to the media question, though, the other question is beyond media, news media is media, new media, AI. Larry Ellison has this Project Stargate, which I know it sounds science fiction, but what Stargate is it's his intention for a DNA registry of, I guess, everyone on the planet, but certainly everyone in America, ostensibly as a healthcare database. But it's odd to think, but I wouldn't any longer, of course, trust government with everyone's DNA or Larry Ellison for that matter. I'm projecting intention onto it. But even if it's down to what if a database of everyone's DNA were weaponized? What if someone got into government who didn't have the self-control necessary not to abuse a DNA database?
Yeah, hypotheticals certainly don't mean you're projecting intentionality. And I think that's an appropriate thing for us to address all the potential hypotheticals.
I mean, given that I personally don't trust Donald Trump or his administration with maintaining my best interests or those of other humans in my country, I shudder to think what they would do or why they want a DNA registry of everybody, why they're taking the DNA of everyone who wants to, come into the country.
Yeah, I think that it's regardless of what happens in 2026 and 2028, right? Even if we've got I know he's not constitutionally allowed, but even if we had President Mamdani and a compliant Congress and, you know, we impeached all the crazy ass corrupt judges and had all the quote unquote good right people in place, we need a generational refiguring of the American mindset to get us past the kind of division and suspicion and demonization that make it possible for people to trust government again. And I'm not sure we should ever trust government enough again to have a DNA inventory operation. But, you know, I do think that, you know, when I talk in those terms about like a generational shift in very fundamental headspace about government and humanity, right? Because in some respects, the reason we're suspicious, the reason people are suspicious of government tends to flow from how they feel about humanity and what they think other people want and are up to and willing to do and all of those things. And so I think it can feel very daunting to try to contemplate, what do you mean we have to change everyone's brains over the course of the next generation? But I think there's also reason for hope about that, because we have seen those kind of generational things happen in the past in less than a generation. In the U.S., right, the some of the reddest areas of the country used to be union strongholds. The societal attitudes towards gay people changed dramatically in less than a generation. Even looking at the Axis powers.
Yeah. And MAGA happened seemingly overnight. You know, so if it, you know, the shift from Tea Party to MAGA was rather fast and based on a brittle moment and a certain cult of personality and certain national trauma between, 9/11 and other things. So I am hopeful that things could flip as quickly and easily in a different direction, you know, not necessarily mine, but something better and different. I mean,
right.
Repairing our international relationships, you know, will take a whole lot of time. You know, I do think that this could be as disruptive to whatever we want to call it, the post-World War II world order as World War II was to the world order. You know, Europe is going to have to be something else than what it was. It could ultimately, I mean, there would have been such a healthier way to get there, right? If someone became president of the United States and went to NATO and said, you know, this American imperialism thing, it worked for us for a while. It's not really working for us anymore. We want to kind of become something more like a nation, like you all are, kind of more like we're all brother and sister nations rather than us being responsible for everybody. How do you want to do this transition? How can we unwind some of this shittiness?
Right.
There was a way to do that. But so now it's unwound, right? it's unwound on a different level. We can come back to the table, I think, and, you know, chastened. But I think there can be a different but perhaps even healthier world order after we go through this thing.
Yeah, in a way, it's weird because I think that's right. But it's like after World War II, the world reverted to a much better place very quickly, right? And it's almost as though we have not had hit bottom hard and fast enough for people to reject it entirely and thoroughly the way they did after World War II. The other thing in terms of, you know, talking about international trust, right? Because to some extent, these alliances rely on other nations trusting that, for instance, we will honor, what is it, NATO Article 5 or whatever, we will come to your defense, right. Those kinds of things. there are sort of two levels of trust required. And my hope is that most other nations and leaders won't be smart enough to recognize both of them. And here's what I mean. On some level, there's no way any international leader is going to 100% trust President Trump going forward, right? The bigger danger is that they won't trust the American people anymore not to give them another President Trump, right? They used to, I think, be able to rely on the American population to put in place leaders who fell within certain parameters of sanity, right? They might not have been thrilled with Ronald Reagan, but they didn't see that as such a wholesale rejection of the established world order and sanity and logic as going with Trump was. And that is potentially, as I said, sort of a generational length problem for the U.S. is international leaders going, you know what? Your population is too screwed up for me to put my eggs in your basket.
Well, our population is too screwed up right now, or enough of it.
For them to do that, yes. But I also think that a large part of the reason we look screwed up is because the portion that's always been screwed up got a little bit too big, right? It's always been there, right? It's really just been a question of managing the size of that population. The real problem was the people who got disengaged.
Yeah, the problem is people got disengaged. The part of people who were engaged for, let's call them wrong reasons, for icky reasons, they could be mobilized by other people.
Right.
To support them, just as, you know, just as, let's say, the Democratic Party has been able, cynically, but for whatever reasons, to leverage people who want to legalize pot or keep abortion legal. They can find an issue and leverage those people to support.
Right.
And we've seen it ultimately corrupt administrations as well over time. So they found, you know, between Bannon, look at all these Gamergate boys. They're angry. They're online all day. There's a lot of them. We can use them. You know, we can use these ones. We can use the ones who are afraid of trans athletes. We can use, you know, and they created this. Right. So in the end, part of what we're seeing is as long as someone believes in something enough to be engaged, they are useful. You know?
Sure,
and
sure.
There's not a lot of people yet who are willing to be engaged. So I guess what I'm saying, and back to the very beginning, is part of the way I sought to engage people was by warning them about impending authoritarianism and fascism and all. And now it feels like, oh, we're sort of in this thing. So it's almost as if our tactics or my tactics are different now, that it's more. And I think what's actually consonant with your perspective is, yes, but it's not about recognizing that thing. It's about recognizing what is happening around you in your life or in the places that you can verify. And how are you going to act against or act about them?
Right. Right. And I also think, and this is part of another part of the reason that I try to focus or at least advocate for focusing on issues within specific silos, is that you've got a lot of super well-intentioned, principled, ethical people out there right now conducting the war for the hearts and minds of America online by basically saying, this is fascist, that's bad, blah, 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 blah. And I suspect we would do better if everyone would specialize a bit more and focus on issues where they are both better informed, but also more effective at conversion. And because I think that we tend to revert to sort of panic mode when we're fighting to save the world. And I think that, you know, anytime you drill into effective debating on a specific issue, first of all, it doesn't involve panic, but also it doesn't involve what we've been talking about before, dehumanization, right? It involves sort of interrogating on this specific issue, where are you? What are your goals? Let's walk through what are effective ways to achieve your goals, right? Because the goals of people who are, even the goals of openly xenophobic anti-immigrant people are not being especially well dealt with here. And, you know, there are reasons to want some immigrants who are here not to be here. I would argue that that number is vanishingly small, statistically speaking, but you can have a conversation even with a xenophobic immigrant opponent, and if you're informed and you're dispassionate and you haven't dehumanized them, I think you can get them to see that this is a wildly inefficient, wasteful, harmful approach to doing it. I would argue that if your concern is about criminal immigrants, well, we already have a mechanism for catching criminals. We have the FBI. And by the way, we also have state and local police. They catch immigrants all the time. That's their job. There's no evidence that ICE in its current iteration is pioneering some new, more effective, more deep drilling approach to rounding up criminal immigrants.
Right. But it could be, and this is what takes me back to intention, though. I hate to do this at the very end of this conversation, but if the intention is just to create the most profitable way for a few corrupt people to ransack as much money as they can from systems, you know, privatized prisons for I mean, then or get airplanes and get $1 billion per nation to have a role in the Middle East real
peace
estate
board, yeah,
peace board. If you start looking at it like that, then it feels like going after any one of these issues is tilting at the windmill, or is going for the decoy, and we're not understanding or undermining the core campaign here, which is to enrich themselves.
Yeah, maybe, but when it's unknowable whether that is the core campaign,
right,
then I think it's going to be
what
tough.
Can you do?
Yeah, just to come up with any sort of approach.
Right.
And I also think for individuals out there, for the love of God, let's not tell them your task is to save the world.
No, it's not to save the world. But I suppose someone could say, okay, what I'm going to specialize in is understanding nonviolent resistance, because yeah, I believe that these folks are coming to New York, and I'm going to learn everything I can from everything that's happening in Minneapolis, what tactics are working, what are not, how are they teaching, you know, because they have these giant, you know, town meetings where they're teaching people nonviolent resistance and how to watch out for your neighbors, what's working, what's not. And I'm going to start doing events in Brooklyn or Manhattan for citizens to learn how can we be resilient in the face of a potential, you know, invasion by, you know, the military. Is that a fair thing for people to work on? I mean, it's rather than
of course,
a global issue,
essential.
Rather than learning. It is. So rather than necessarily having about Zionism or water policy or the Federal Reserve, I could just specialize in human tactics on the ground.
Sure. Yeah. And you could even specialize in human tactics on the ground for your issue, right? The tactics may be different for sustainable energy, climate change, than immigration, certainly. And
right,
these aren't even tactics for immigration. These are tactics for aggressive, unlawful enforcement measures under the rubric of
right,
immigration, and arguably, unknowably, about something else. But also, I think it would be really helpful for people to, I don't mean this to sound like I'm going back on what I said earlier, but to get sort of global about specific issues, things like if checks and balances is really important to you, right? Instead of railing against authoritarianism, right? Maybe sell the advantages of the alternative. We see like everything right now in our political messaging and even in our media is this is bad. We're anti this. It seems to me really important that we revive and celebrate. What are the things that we envision and used to have in place of this? Why is collective action so fucking great? Why are checks and balances so amazing? Why is arguing essential, right? All of these things, I think we've let things like rugged individualism and all these narratives and myths enter the consciousness and be accepted widespread in really toxic ways. So you've got even the Democratic Party is like, we need to find candidates who were good at war or who made money at business, and they should be politicians. There's arguably those experiences are arguably antithetical, but it's because Democrats have been so, and I don't mean people, the party leadership, the campaign consultants, they've all been so conditioned to sort of love those things, right? Ooh, war, that's super sexy. Wore a uniform, we can put that up. Businessman, they achieve success by a metric that we recognize. Those are so much easier and have less downside than celebrating, oh, I don't know, a community organizer who just happens to be the most successful politician of the last quarter century or generation. So I think people can specialize in those kinds of things too, not necessarily bashing warriors running for office or business people running for office, although arguably, like if you succeeded at extracting money from people, I would argue that's not who we want holding the levers of power. But my point is, we don't even have to demonize them. Let's celebrate and rejoice over the communal collective things that actually do produce good outcomes for everyone, right? I think it's important to recognize what are the narratives and mythologies and ideologies and isms that sort of fundamentally underlie the things that give us good outcomes historically.
Right. Which is why, you know, what I've been focusing on lately are things like, you know, Minneapolis doing a friggin' general strike. Putting the language of general strike back into the conversation. Having students and friends going, oh, there have been general strikes before? You know? These are real. It's a thing. The whole nations have done it.
I will say that your name, your brand name, lives up to the things I'm talking about much better than mine does. The fucking news is like a negative, complainy thing. Team Human is beautiful. Yay. It's beautiful. Oh. And also in terms of like a general strike, the sort of beauty of a general strike is it's almost explicit in saying something that is more important, something has more value than the daily churn and financial transactions that define our lives, right? That's the underpinning message. Something's more important than this daily bullshit.
Right. I mean, when they were still progressives, the Israelites came up with that in the desert, right? One day off, you know, it's a sacred thing. One day to celebrate being human, just the way you are. You're entitled to that. It's the law. God.
It's holy.
You know? Yeah.
They were cool.
They were cool. But again, I'm going to celebrate that rather than whatever else may have happened in the subsequent couple thousand years. Dude, I love you. I love the fucking news. Everyone should subscribe to the fucking news. I'll tell you here, you can get Kobe wherever the heck you want, but go to Kobe Clean, the website, and find it there. Put Kobe in your web browser and get these laundry buds, and they will rock your skin and your dryer and the world. If you don't want to hear stuff about Kobe or any of these ads, but know that they still sponsor us, you can subscribe to Team Human as a paying subscriber by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support, or go to the aforementioned patreon.com/teamhuman. to find us there, get on the Discord, and just support and be here. But even if you don't do that, share this with your friends, click on those little hearts or checks or likes or things. All these little metrics matter to the algorithms, and then the algorithms will tell more people that they too can be on Team Human rather than on Team Algorithm. So join us. Join us here each week, my friend. You're sure to get a smile. You remember that. From two stranded castaways here on Team Human Isle. I love you. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Michael Gargiulo stalked and slaughtered his female neighbors in L.A. in the 2000s until one survived.
She painted a picture that you could never imagine.
In a first on Mind of a Monster, we dive into a case that's still active. Did Michael's murderous rampage start in the 1990s when he was just 17?
His impulsivity and his rage was starting to peak around that age.
Listen to Mind of a Monster, The Hollywood Ripper, wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.